This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So good afternoon, good evening. So I would like to acknowledge somebody who's joining us this evening, Rick Clark. He's another Flatlander out here north of Chicago. It's a guy I've been practicing with for a number of years. So welcome, Rick.
Thank you.
So, I just caught it, an email from Doug after this afternoon. And it was about language. It took me further along a path that I was going to be touching on today. And I think it's leading me to go into it. And I'm not sure where this is going to take me or take us. So we'll see. The spirit of it is this poem. Maybe I'll read more than one over this evening, but... I don't know if any of you have heard of Claudia Rankine, the poet Claudia Rankine. Her new book, Just Us, An American Conversation, I would highly recommend it. It's essays, but she starts out with a few poems. And I say that, yeah, this is a spirit. When I think of Hua Yin, it's actually, for me, it's dependent origination, and it's the spirit of something. What does it mean to want? An age-old call for change, not to change. And yet also to feel bullied by the call to change. How is a call to change named shame, named penance, named chastisement? How does one say what if without reproach? The root of chastise is to make pure. The impossibility of that, is that what repels and not the call for change? So the gist of my talk, it still is going to be, I'm going to start with that anyway, is to sort of share sort of my experience with Hua Yin. And back up here a little bit, we've been talking about the massive size of this sutra. And one of the things that in this sharing I hope to sort of convey is sort of coming back to that sense of jewels reflecting. It's that way with the Dharma. This is one of my experiences. It's that way with the Dharma. And so I hope to do a little bit of, what I share. I hope it sort of, you get the sense, or hope it makes sense to you that that reflecting. I took part in a weekend retreat with the contemporary Chan master Gua Gu a while back. And if you have the chance, I would recommend it. When he sort of did an overview of Chan and Buddhism coming into China. And he said, you know, at a certain point in China, Buddhism, things got slimmed down a bit. And I think of that, you know, thinking of that with this line from the Song of the Jewel Miramati, the translation that's in the record of Tongshan. And it was one of the translations, Doug, that you shared last year at Denkoe when we were taking up the Jewel Song of the Jewel Mirror Samadhi. And it goes something like this. The mind not resting in words accommodates what arises. Now for me, that's book 11. And another thing that I'd like to touch on is, since I heard this last year at an insight meditation retreat, and I just caught this line, and it stuck with me. It's the gathering and folding in. And I look back over the years of practice, and that's it. That pretty much sums it up, gathering and folding in. But there's really, you know, an aliveness to the gathering and folding in. I first heard of the Huayin School of Buddhism without hearing about the Huayin School of Buddhism. All I heard about was Indra's net. I didn't hear about the Avatamsaka Sutra or anything else, just Indra's net. And it really made a big impression on me. It, you know, as I took that in, it was a very humbling experience to think about that. Very simply, you know, all these jewels in the net. One jewel reflecting throughout all the others and all the other jewels reflecting in the one. And it is the humbling part of it was, man, really taking care. But I'll be honest, I mean, it made a big impression on me, and it's really stuck with me, but there's been a lot of attuning and tuning going on, as I mentioned earlier. And then, you know, for years, the teacher who first ordained me really talked a lot about the 12 links of dependent origination. And so I just heard about dependent origination in that context. And then once I came across this line, I think it was an article by Thich Nhat Hanh and the Patikasamuppada. This existing that exists. This arising that arises. This not existing that no longer exists. This ceasing that ceases. I'll read it again. This existing that exists. This arising that arises. This not existing that no longer exists. This ceasing, that ceases. This really opened up things for me. It was just like a lightning bolt that went straight from dependent origination to Dogen, actually. And it reminds me that a piece of art that you all did there at Jokoji, it sort of reminded me of that yellow. Is that like a yellow road? It was kind of like a sort of jagged flash of lightning that went. And then sometime later, I came across this in Stephen Batchelor's After Buddhism. By and large, and he was talking to someone named Kachin Nagata of the Kachin lineage. No more identity than that. By and large, Kachana, this world relies on the duality of it is and it is not. But one who sees the arising of the world as it happens with complete understanding has no sense of it is not about the world. And one who sees the ceasing of the world as it happens with complete understanding has no sense of it is about the world. Now, and I took that in, I was just holding in the tension of that, and for me, it was like this happening again. That bolt of lightning going across to Dogen, this time lining up a little bit brighter, Nagarjuna. So this, the dependent origination in this sense, for me, that, you know, it echoes throughout the, it's there in Nagarjuna, it's there in the koans, it's there in Dogen. It was like the sort of like the Big Bang theory goes, starting at something, just this very concise insights, then go through to the, you know, to the mushrooming in the Mahayana literature, and then it came into, you know, and then as Guagu says, things got slimmed down a bit. So this question, about language. First of all, you know, I like, regarding attuning and tuning, Mahesh, I'd like to apologize because I don't think I was too attuned when I answered you today. I wasn't too tuned in. And the reason why is that, well, as I reflected on it, it was the, when you were asking about your heart, and what and the response came from a heart that had been broken and hardened. It came from that experience. I'm not sure that it spoke to your experience. So for that miscue, I apologize.
No, it was helpful. Yeah, thank you.
But this language thing and this sense of the Patikasamapada and this Buddhist statement to Kachana, it really, you know, for me, it takes away words. go into beyond words. And it comes back to, I don't know, I'm having a hard time putting it into words right now, because it is a sense that of being on the cusp of something. Always being on the cusp of something. Sam Hamill, I think, sort of gets it. In this poem, in the beginning, not the word, but that which precedes the word, not a word, but what composes words, alpha and beta, a bull's horns upended, perhaps authenticating the awe of cognition, memory. I'm not sure about this name. Mnemosyne is mother of the muses, memory growing tree-like. It is true, the root of tree and truth is Drew, the people of the tree. Also the family of memory, which flowers, grows perpetually, widening concentric rings to the single grain of sand dropped into the surf, extending its sphere of influence to the world's farthest shores, an elemental image at core. Does not speak to Huayin. That sense of being with, how do we find our language together? Claudia, in this whole book, is living in question. And for me, this practice, you know, there is a deepening sense of living in question. Without putting too fine a point on it. But we, how do we make our way with each other? For me, when I think of the flower garland sutra, it's all relational. And it boils down to just, it's all relational. And how do we make our way? The mind not resting in words accommodates what arises. There's another book that I'm trying to get people to come in with me on this book. It's called The Dharma of Natural Systems, Mutual Causality in Buddhism and General Systems Theory. When I take in this book Dependent origination systems. So and I think about Buddhism, and I think about its relevance. Zen, Buddhism, relevant. So Doug's question about the language in Book 11 took me a little bit further in. How do we come together with our disparate histories, if you will, narratives, and our disparate conditionings, and be alive to each other? The mind not resting in words. How do we come to each other? There's a there's and there's this term, co-created reality, if you will, co-created something, and two people come together and they do this exploring. Gentle curiosity. The mind not resting in words. I almost forgot. Batchelor, after that statement, a Buddhist statement to the Kachana, goes on to say, for one who no longer thinks in terms of it is and it is not, there can be no ontological basis for ethics. Now, as I'm putting this out here, and I'm not asking you to believe it. I'm asking to take it in, and then I'll shut up here in a little bit. I'd like to see what's coming up for you. A legalistic moral code, by contrast, tends to be based in the assumption that bad actions have a certain intrinsic nature, whereas good actions have quite a different nature. Those who are moral, therefore, follow the rules laid out in this code with the complacent assurance of knowing they are right. But those who have entered the stream of the path have become independent of others. Not being tied to a code of conduct devised by others, they will respond in unpredictable ways to whatever moral dilemmas they encounter. They will do so with empathy, intelligence, and compassion, not by first checking with the moral rule book to see what it is allowed, to see what is allowed. And he goes on to say that these folks have to be aware they're going to stumble, they're going to make mistakes, they're going to blow it. So, you know, the sense coming through right now is that since we drop away from our narratives, our paradigms, our fixed views, and make our way. But with this exquisite sense of a dependent origination, dependent co-arising, and that sense of humility and taking care and coming together in question, as opposed to I laying my reality on yours and you laying your reality on mine and coming up with answers. We come together in search of creating something together, a sense of something together. And like I'm doing right now, I think there's a lot of stumbling around and there's a lot of pain. So after, you know, as I was contemplating this afternoon, I thought of, you know, this from the Radical Dharma. A collection of essays, this one by Jasmine Sayadula, talking about her practice with Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams. Reverend Angel would actually call out whatever felt funky as soon as it arose and we faced it as a group. She wouldn't let me disappear into myself. She would name it if she saw me trying to be at home in whiteness, exceptionalism, mammy mentality, and would have no qualms about asking me to stop, adjust my posture, and take up the room I occupy, and no more. I needed someone to give me permission to leave pretense and find home in myself, in my own power, before I could decenter my ego. I needed directions about how to keep going in the face of institutional racism, sexism, and homophobia. I needed someone strong enough to hold the space of my practice without being nice, with no apologies for the way she expressed her love. I needed a sangha led by fierce-ass emotionality expressive, passionate queer women of color. I needed to be surrounded by role models, practitioners who were, like me, extraordinary and perfectly imperfect. We were waking together with and against the grain of each other's practice, and it could get messy. A lot of courage there. I found that very inspiring. So I'll shut up here. I just wanted to share. It's an interesting thing that happens during sesshins. And I've been finding this more and more. Things get turned upside down, inside out, according to expectations. And sort of making a clumsy attempt here to speak to more what's really alive with what's working here for me. So I'd like to hear from you and what's coming up. And please be honest.
Thank you. I really enjoyed following you, your path through this talk. I missed a few spots, but it was really It was really masterful. And I liked going that way. And I don't know if I could find my way back, but I wish I could be that eloquent, and sometimes I can, but I love bringing in poetry and just bringing in things that you've found here and there, because that's usually the way I prepare when I have to give a talk. And this time I was pretty overwhelmed, and the subject matter was kind of overwhelming for me too, but I'm really enjoying this, and I thank you. Thank you very much. It would be nice if somehow you could give Doug some of your references that we could look up after session.
You said something which I don't remember how to paraphrase, but it was you said many things, but this one was about I think it was from Stephen Batchelor. You said something about morality and moral code. and like looking for finding easy answers in some way, resting in easy answers, having a rule book and imposing our reality on situations and people. And maybe because of where I'm from and when I grew up, where I grew up in Iran during dictatorship, and then the upheaval of the revolution, and then moving to Texas during the hostage crisis and facing racism. And not being able to, I mean, I had many friends, well, not many, but dear friends. But being caught between two worlds in my own culture, also, I saw the dogma, especially after the revolution, even before the revolution. And now in the United States, we see the dogma pretty clearly in front of us. And then it seems like every time I see the dogma, it meets me inside me. Like I have to let go of some dogma inside me when I'm faced with dogma that I see to be unfair, wrong. And the only, I fall into this dish many times of judgments and anger and, hey, I'm not a fucking desert nigger or whatever you call me, or we don't all behead people, or not, or blacks are not bad people, or Jews are not like this, or, you know, white people are not like all like this. It's a really coarse one I'm saying, but so, you know, about the danger of falling into dogma, but the dogma is in us also, you know. And I don't know, maybe you have some words about how to free ourselves from dogma. I just can't think of just not judging and having a, you know, open attitude towards, you know, people with which we disagree, meeting them somehow. And then the other part of it, the second part of it, was in the same statement by Stephen Bashter. He talked about empathy and not the people who are free don't take a moral code into situations, may behave in unpredictable ways based on what they perceive the situation to need, which may not meet our standards of, you know, behavior and ethics and so on. That's true. At the same time, there certainly has been a lot of history of abuse of that among so-called enlightened masters in Zen, in Tibetan Buddhism, in every tradition, in Iran, amongst priest class, in every religion. So, you know, I just feel like that has to be approached with a lot of allowing people to rebel against that and question them in those communities, and not fall in line with this is a deity that cannot make mistakes.
Would you say that there, you know, what's coming up for me when you said that this need for space? Does that register with you?
Yes, very much. Yes. Yeah. I didn't say that word, but somehow you felt that that's what I'm referring to. Yes, space. Yes.
Yeah. What's coming up for me right now with that is the sense of suffocation that comes when that space isn't there. and the loss of voice and not being seen and heard. How's that for you?
Yes, in my life, it's very important to give everybody space. And I don't like it when I don't. But yes, I try to come back and... Yes, space to express themselves. Are you a psychologist?
No, I'm a clinical social worker.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, thank you. All right. You have a lot of gift for seeing what's behind what somebody says. I didn't even see it, but yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Emmy?
Thank you, Chuck. Thank you for talking. And I just what came up when Kaveh was talking and you answered was, I have a nephew who has a t-shirt and it has a few planets on it and a lot of stars. And it says, I need my space. I was like that t-shirt. I think it's really important too. But I like so much many things you said. But just a couple of them are in your question of how we come together. I think this is a really wondrous example of coming together, all of us here now, with mind and with mind and heart, with mind and body, being compassionate and full of empathy. And so maybe we quiet our minds and so we can open our heart and listen to each other. I also really like the mind not resting in words, accommodates what arises. And entering the stream is another concept that I've heard before, especially from Aya Kema, that I think is so important for all of us and what we're doing with learning the way and learning the teachings and studying the sutras. And again, it's really remarkable that we have each other now in this time of so much contention, that here we are listening to each other and letting everything just be. Thank you.
Tyson?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chuck. I have a question for you, just, you know, based on an observation, and it seems like we're in a time where, especially among what we might call progressive folks, but probably overall everyone, there's an increasing encouragement to have identities, you know, to celebrate identities. And the more identities you have, the better. And, you know, I was thinking the other day that the cloth that identities are made from is grievance. And I just was wondering about how you think about that, especially in the context of no self. And so we've got these kind of Buddhist encouragements to just let go of all of these fictional identities, lack of inherent existences, like you quoted Nagarjuna. And yet there's this encouragement to really identify with, I mean, there's so many different kinds of levels that people identify with that they oftentimes have a hard time knowing which grievance would take precedence. So anyway, I just wondered what you thought about that.
There's, you know, when you first talked about grievance, I missed a word in there. Could you, I don't know if you can go back to that line.
It's kind of a tagline. I was just saying that the clock, you know, I always think of identities as like gowns that we put on.
Yeah.
You know, we've got, oh, I'm a this, I'm a that, here's my gown. And the cloth though, that those identities are made from, is maybe I should just say primarily grievance.
Oh, where do you come to, how do you come to that?
Just from kind of listening to people. And, you know, like just take like an example of culture, the celebration of culture in the positive aspects of it, when it's not exclusionary, it's just so joyous, but it's inclusive. And therefore you don't have to be a member of that, whatever it is, you know, name it. Everyone is included. It's one of the things I love about Buddhism, well, at least as my understanding of it. Zen Buddhism makes no difference who you are, what color, where you come from, any of the notions of identity, because at the foundation is no solid self. And these things are actually fictional. And although they can be useful and we have to inhabit it in order to exist in our societies, but at a fundamental level, they're just, you know, made up of, they're make-believe in a certain sense. But see, that even is very insulting. So maybe I should withdraw that one.
Well, I come back with that question. I keep coming back to this statement, the Kachana. And I come back to this quite often when I'm in this quandary. It's, you know, this world relies on the duality of it is and it is not. But one who sees the arising of the world as it happens with complete understanding has no sense of it is not about the world. And one who sees the ceasing of the world as it happens with complete understanding has no sense of it is about the world. Nagarjuna just, you know, he just took that and ran with it. And I guess it would be interesting, wouldn't it, to really go into this, you know, with our experiences about what you're talking about, you know, because that's the same thing about self, not self. So when we, you know, and that's the beauty, I think, of Huayin, our dependent origination. Because where, when we talk about not self, when we look at all of the, begin to fathom this expression right here, this talking? What led to it, this expression right now? And this identity that it might hold to, or identities it might hold to. When we look at all that, we can see into the, you know, seeing clearly, we can see into the fabrication. When we see into the fabrication, I think we're seeing into the emptiness. But we also see the fabrication. But we also have hearts. And coming back to attuning. I don't know if you know, her name is Thanissara. She wrote the book, Time to Stand Up. It's a good book. And at one point in there, she said, the Buddha knew where everything was on the matrix at any given point in time. I love that. Where is it? I got all this stuff around me. In the latest issue of Tricycle, there's this article that's a sense of that. Wait a minute, I'm getting detracted. I'll back up. So seeing into the emptiness. The Buddha knew how to speak to this. He was that attunement. So did somebody like Lin Shi. You know, I can't remember the four parts that he came from, you know, coming from emptiness, coming from form, coming from emptiness, coming from form. I forget form emptiness. I forget that is dynamic. But it was his hearing about how to speak to a lot of people. That word grievance, I think, is a good one. Because they haven't been heard. And it's very important that they be heard. I think this is what this practice is really, for me, is when we talk about being present, is enable the possibility of somebody being really heard. So on the one hand, I can have this appreciation of where this expression might, how it came to be. I may not know the full detail. I can maybe, or just surmise that, you know, all the history of the conditioning led to this. And maybe hear the grievance in the voice, that this needs to be heard. I think what helps me with this is that keeps me from putting a label on that person. While I can hear the grievance. That's been very hard the last 4 years. But there are a lot of people who out there haven't been heard. In fact, you know, it's not only can they not be heard, is can they live safely without being killed for the, but this goes in so many different directions. I'm slowly making my way through this book in a different voice by Carol. I can't remember her last name. Maybe somebody here knows it, but it's she wrote it back in the early 70s about the feminine voice.
Carol Gilligan,
yes.
ahead, Michael.
Yeah, I'm not understanding a lot of the terms you're using. Like, you're using this codependent origination, I think. I'm not familiar with a lot of the terminology. I don't know if you explain that, what that term is referring to.
Okay. I think this is the clearest example of it that I've heard. These four lines. This existing that exists. This arising that arises. This not existing that no longer exists. This ceasing that ceases. So everything is dependent on a whole host of other things for its existence. And when any of these causes and conditions cease to be, then that existence is threatened. It may cease to be too. It's how everything is dependent on everything else for its existence. And we have some idea, but taking in how we come to, just very simply considering our existence and what it's dependent on, all that it's dependent on. And we think that it's me and I'm the show. So that's, for me, that's where, that dependent origin, I was toying around this week with this, trying to come up with some image of causes and conditions and color coded and shapes and forms, and all this stuff coming, arising and falling away in different forms and passing away. That's about the best I can explain it, but maybe somebody else here can add in too. I'd certainly welcome that.
Thank you.
Carolyn?
Thank you. Thank you for the talk. It came to me when you said you were going around with the idea of an image that would express that. And the image that came to me is the neural synaptic firing of the brain. So, which is also relates it in my mind for what I wanted to say about some of the points of your talk and how around Indra's net, because I heard quite some time ago that and then I've heard it, it was like almost unbelievable to me, but I've heard it since and read it a few times, that actually the way the human brain synaptic firings go, there are so many more trillions of those than there are atoms in the cosmos or like that. And it's sort of remarkable. It's also kind of somehow fits in with dependent origination and certainly interconnection, how everything is so interconnected. I think I wanted to express too how another image, perhaps, how you're about Indra's net, which was a very, struck a real chord for me. And until I started practicing Buddhism on Buddhist traditions, I hadn't come across that image, but that too, just sort of, it kind of lit up something, this whole, how
how remarkably complex and beautiful everything is in a way. And what I really enjoyed is how you threaded through the beauty and the difficulty not being separate, but being together, beginning with Claudia Rankine. And the last piece that I'll take time with was one way that thread came together was then you brought in that book, I've forgotten the name, although I've read it, of Angel Kyoto Williams and Lama Rod and the other woman, Jacqueline, of how people need to be heard and finding the language to listen and finding the language to speak. And Claudia Rankine in her first book, a recent book, found that language to speak without making an identity that Taizan talks about. Somehow you could just be with her, at least that's what I felt. So thank you. Your whole talk was sort of like an Indra's net for me. Thank you so much.
I was just going to say too, Michael, that the way I think of how some people think that they're self-made, you know, that they're not, that like, for instance, successful people sometimes, especially very, very rich people, you see this kind of selfishness and this kind of, I did this on my own. And you hear that and you go, you are so delusional. And all of the people, all of the causes and conditions, but also all of the people that make this world habitable and do it for such little amount of money. My sister Robin had Down syndrome, and I was her conservator for the last few years of her life. And it got me in touch with this group of people who take care at these, you know, community day centers and things like that, where people with developmental problems go. And they do it for almost minimum wage with no retirement, you know, minimal amounts of anything. And the work is really challenging. And you know, this is just one instance of how this world, you know, rolls to the extent it does based on all of these people. And somehow that's left out of the people who feel like, you know, hey, I made it on my own. I just worked for what I did and I, you know, and I was successful. And, you know, so I think of that in terms of dependent origination. I don't know, Chuck, does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
Thank you for the talk, Chuck. It was, for me, it was like jazz. Lots of instruments coming in, playing a different riff, and I enjoyed it a lot. The part that, of course, really grabbed me is your question, how do we make our way with each other? And the sense of co-creating every moment, like right now, what we're doing, is near and dear to my heart. I just spent a lot of time thinking about who's meeting whom in every single moment. I'm kind of fascinated and drawn by this question because it strikes me all the time that when I encounter anyone, anything, that something is happening, but I really have no idea what it is. And it has something to do with my presence, but not a whole lot, just something. It has something to do with everything that's ever happened. And it's also with you right now and all of you right now. But I don't really know if we have a name for that, which takes me back to your comment about mind not resting in words. but accommodating what arises. I think that's how we live. At least I think that's our practice, that we don't really know what's happening ever. And we can't shed all of our conditioning and the things that brought us to this moment. We can't leave them out of the door, but we can also meet what's happening, which is a way of leaving all that stuff outside the door. So I think those intersections, I think we can call them intersections. Maybe that's a good word for meeting moment by moment. Maybe that word doesn't really work either, but in any event, lots of intersections. I'm really appreciate your talking, addressing like how do we do this with each other? Because there's no other way except with each other.
I think, what kind of time do we have, Doug?
Yeah, it's 4.
Before we chant out, I just wanted to say I was, I told somebody recently that every time I go to Jokoji, I fall in love. And it, you know, not romantic love, but I fall in love. That I had that experience in Denkoe in 2016. When Vanya was there, and again last year. And it's the spirit of the place, it's the spirit of you all. Coming back to what we were talking about this afternoon, the heart, it's really helped my heart. And so, my time spent with you, even online here, it's sitting next to this computer and sort of just like looking through a window into the Zendo. This afternoon, when you were all sitting out on the deck, it was just, or this morning, and listening to all the sounds, the birds and the wildlife. Man, that did a number. A lot of deep gratitude and to Doug and Nico for all the work that you've been doing to keep this pulled together. So thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.